Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining me today on the Class War Battlefield podcast. Please do me the honor of supporting this work that I am doing. I've been doing this work now for free on your behalf for, my God, 11 years. 5, 10, 20, 50. If you can afford it, please do. Cash at me at $CWB Podcast. CWB Podcast. Cash App it. CWB Podcast. Also, hit me up on PayPal. CWB Podcast. All the way across the board, y'all. Help me out. Thank you for donating and enjoy the show.
And this is one of my introductory lectures about administrative law and regulatory agencies. Here I'm going to be talking about the legal backdrop, the big picture legal framework to help my students get their bearings before we start studying cases and individual or specific legal concepts. So, and again, this is going to be useful not only for an administrative law class, but also for statutory interpretation and regulation classes or leg reg classes that have a section of the semester that's about the administrative state. So let's dive in here and get our bearings. Okay, the first thing you need to understand is the statutes. So let's talk about the statutes. And for purposes of this area of law, we can really talk about two types of statutes. And the first type is going to be enabling statutes. Sometimes these are called the organic statute or the governing statute in a case or by your casebook authors. And examples would be, say, the Endangered Species Act, which is pictured here, the Clean Air Act, the National Labor Relations Act, the Federal Trade Commission Act, and so on. And there's hundreds and hundreds of these, right? And some create agencies, and then they empower agencies. Some, if an agency already exists, a new act may give new powers and authority or tasks to that agency. And so basically, these statutes are acts of Congress, or on the state level, a state legislature, that delegate authority to regulate, to enforce, to run different types of programs. And these things also restrain the agencies, right? So they empower them and they also set the boundaries of their authority. And so this is their statutory mandate that not only gives them the legal authority to act, but also sets the limits or the parameters of their authority. Now, we also have in this area of law some very important general or generic statutes that apply to every agency with a few exceptions. And the big one is the Administrative Procedure Act that was passed in the late 1940s, again, pictured here. And another example would be the Freedom of Information Act, which we usually just call FOIA, or the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA. And what these do is they create basically procedural requirements or protocols that all the agencies have to follow. So the Administrative Procedure Act, which we will have a whole unit on, spells out different methods or processes for promulgating rules or adjudicating cases and running hearings, and a little bit about judicial review and the standards of review that courts are going to use. The Freedom of Information Act is a transparency in government statute that allows private parties to petition an agency for information that agency has. Agencies collect a lot of information. And so again, this isn't anything substantive about agencies have to implement certain policies. This is just about making documents available to the public upon request. And then the National Environmental Policy Act, it basically requires the agency to do some procedural steps of studying the environmental impact of their actions before they take them. Now, we have other legal texts that are going to come up in this course and that affect the agencies and that are part of this, again, body of law that agency officials and regulators have to follow. So we have executive orders and then probably secondarily presidential memoranda and so forth. There's not a big legal difference between these, but a president, as the head of the executive branch, can direct agencies to do certain things. And often this is put in very official written form and published and studied so that there's a document of it. We also have some judicially created law or judicial doctrines, like certain very specific due process requirements, something we call hard look review that we will look at later in the course, presumption against preemption, and so forth. And so what has happened is, as the judiciary deals with agencies as parties to a case, in a lot of cases, either because someone is challenging something that an agency has done, or the agency is bringing an enforcement action, courts have created special rules for how they're going to handle agencies or that they expect agencies to follow before they ever get into court. And that in turn becomes part of the body of law. Now, the courts, the Supreme Court has insisted that we don't really have a federal common law of administrative law. And there's a sense in which that's true, but we also do have a line of precedence that the agencies are very aware of. Okay, also keep in mind that we have law made by agencies. And as a student, it's pretty important to keep this straight in your mind as you're working through the cases. When are we talking about a law that's directed or addressed to the agency that the agency has to follow? And when is the agency essentially creating law that the regulated industry or the regulated parties have to follow? So when laws or regulations are promulgated by the agency, they're initially published in the Federal Register, and then they'll end up codified in the Code of Federal Regulations. So the CFR is all law generated by regulatory agencies. And in your library, if you've ever wandered around your law library, the set of CFR books, which is much longer than the United States Code, is usually in the neighborhood, right around the same bookshelf as the USC, because it has force of law. But these are legal rules not enacted by Congress, but promulgated by regulatory agencies. Agencies also put out guidance letters, things they call memoranda, and so forth. And we're going to do a unit of this course about whether these have the force of law or not. That's actually a critical question. Also, agencies can do common law style, like case-by-case announcing of rules and sort of creating within precedent within that agency's purview. So if the National Labor Relations Board wants to announce a new policy in a case and an enforcement action that they're bringing, they can do that subject to certain conditions and can announce policy going forward. So this is now how we are going to apply our statute or apply this rule to different cases. And this will look, should be reminiscent to students of the common law judicial precedents system. Also, we have some constitutional issues in this course, and frankly, this is the part of administrative law that you can actually see on the bar exam, like the multi-state bar exam, as con law questions. So we have a whole unit of, when we do administrative law or a section of a legreg course, a regulation course about the administrative state, we have a whole section about the non-delegation doctrine, which is sort of a subset of separation of powers. And so keep in mind, agencies are going to engage in lawmaking in the form of regulations, executive actions in the terms of enforcement, or issuing permits and licenses or dispersing funds, and adjudication, usually through administrative law judges. And there's also some constitutional cases that we have in this body of law about procedural due process. What kind of procedural fairness does an agency have to give to a party when they're deciding a case? Okay, that concludes our quick introductory lecture about the legal backdrop for administrative law.
we live in an era of lawmaking by regulation. In decades past, we saw most of our lawmaking done by legislation and to some degree by judicial interpretation. But things have really, I think, dramatically changed in this era, whether we're talking the era starting in the 1930s or 70s or even just more modern day. There's a Facebook post I show my legislation and regulation students every year that Senator Lee put up in 2014 that I think captures this. It's not a perfect capture, but it gives you a sense of where we're at. And what he has is those three shelves are everything that's in the Federal Register, all the rules, notices of rules, regulations. And then at the very top of that, above it, is everything that Congress passed in that same year. If you want to get a better sense, and I'm pulling these from the last 2 years of the Obama administration to give you a sense of where it's at. Congress passed in those 2 years 329 public laws, 3,000 pages. In the Federal Register, there were over 7,000 final rules, almost 180,000 total pages, but 60,000 of those were dealing with were final rules themselves. Now, this is an imperfect capture of this, of course, because you know, Congress might pass a rule on one page that has a dramatic effect, you know, much more than the 500-word detailed, you know, rule that the agency passes. But it still gives you a sense of where most lawmaking happens today. It's not up on Capitol Hill. It's at federal agencies through the notice and comment process. Another kind of fun way to think of this is if you're trying to read every page, every word in the Code of Federal Regulations, it would take you over 3 years to get through all of that, including more than a million regulatory restrictions. And so it's not, I don't think it's, I don't have a hard argument to make that we live in an era of lawmaking by regulation instead of lawmaking by legislation. Just to kind of give one more example, and we may return to this later, the Regulatory Accountability Act that was proposed has been proposed over the years by Senators Portman and Heitkamp at the time, has a number of different provisions, and we might talk about some of these later, but I circled the last one, and this is the most controversial provision in this proposed legislation, that it would require more formal kind of hearing-like rulemaking for major rules that are over $100 million. There are a lot of exceptions there, and for high-impact rules that are over $1 billion. And I just highlight that even in a piece of bipartisan legislation that's supported by a lot of Republicans, we're already assuming that agencies should be making rules that have an impact of more than $1 billion, as opposed to that being a decision that Congress should make instead of a federal agency. And so what I want to kind of just give you a survey of today is what can Congress do about this? To kind of combat the role, this era we live in of lawmaking by regulation. And I'll just talk briefly about six different options. The first option is do nothing, right? Maybe for a lot of you, you view this as a feature and not a bug. There's some good arguments we can have there. Some folks think that, you know, expert bureaucrats should be the ones that are making our major decisions and not elected representatives. Others may argue that Congress is not representative anymore for a variety of different reasons, whether it's districting or too much of a weight with the Senate and House. And there are a lot of different arguments there. I'm obviously not in that camp. I think it is a bug and not a feature that most of our lawmaking happens at federal agencies and not Congress, especially major decisions. So if you agree with me on that, there are kind of five different tools or approaches that you can have. First is we have the traditional oversight toolkit. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but if you're interested in exploring this further, Josh Chaffetz has a terrific book called Congress's Constitution, where he outlines the various tools Congress has under the Constitution to rein in the administrative state, to combat the executive branch more generally. I did a book review of this in the Michigan Law Review a few years back. And I kind of have this chart that just summarizes his six tools. There's obviously the power of the purse, which is appropriation, spending, budgeting. There's the personnel power that we're going to see a lot of in the next few weeks with Congress through the president's nomination of agency heads and other principal officers at agency. Congress can exercise oversight by asking for commitments from those agency heads about how they're going to run the agency, from withholding holding hearings or the like on those agency heads until they get a commitment that the agency is going to act in a certain way. Of course, under that category, you also have things like removal and impeachment. And then the third one is contempt of Congress. The Congress has the ability to hold agency officials in contempt if they don't actually comply with the oversight functions that are being required of them. Chaffetz also has a number of soft powers, freedom of speech, internal discipline. Go read the book. The last one, the Cameral Rules, though, plays a really important role. Under the Constitution, Congress has the ability to set up its own rules. And what's it's done through that is created committees with oversight that can do investigations, that can subpoena documents and testimony, and exercise other types of oversight tools. I don't understate this. This is a very powerful tool that Congress has to rein in and control the administrative state. I've written separately a number of different articles. I think there's some problems with Congress acting this way and not also legislating, because it's not the collective Congress, oftentimes committees or committee chairs that exercise this power, but it's still a really important tool that Congress has. The second one we're also going to be talking about a lot in the next few weeks. This is the Congressional Review Act. The Congressional Review Act allows Congress to invalidate an agency rule that has been enacted within the last 60 days. One of the kind of key features of this is that the filibuster doesn't apply. It's a fast track approach where both the House and Senate just pass a resolutions on simple majority. At the end of the Obama administration and the beginning of the Trump administration, you saw a lot of rules being invalidated under the Congressional Review Act. It doesn't just invalidate the rule. It also prohibits the agency from enacting a rule that is substantially the same as that rule. Maybe we can talk a little bit more what that means. We're going to see this used a lot. It wasn't used very often before the Trump administration. It'll definitely be used a lot here in the first months of the Biden administration to go back through the last 60 days of rules of the last Congress. Okay, so there's that. Another tool is regulatory reform legislation. In other words, tinkering with the Administrative Procedure Act and other statutes that govern the way agencies regulate. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this here. I want to flag that the U.S. Department of Justice issued a report last year on modernizing the Administrative Procedure Act that goes through a lot of this. I've written a couple articles. The first was looking at some of the reform legislation that had been put up by Republicans back at the start of the Trump administration. And the second one is one I have forthcoming that actually just tracks, gives you a survey of how the Administrative Procedure Act's text departs from how it actually works in practice today, both as a matter of judicial doctrine and as a matter of regulatory practice. In case you want to get a sense of why the Administrative Procedure Act might need to be modernized and the like. There's a number of bills, including that Regulatory Accountability Act, that attempt to do that. Quite a few of them garner at least some bipartisan support, and it'll be interesting to see what happens in the current administration when both houses are controlled by Democrats. Okay, the next one is, well, they could actually legislate more, right? This might be the easy one that you might think of, that it's, you know, an option that you can actually do legislation and not just rely on oversight and Congressional Review Act to do this. This is hard these days to actually get Congress to legislate, to revisit statutes that govern federal agencies. In an article that Jonathan Adler and I published this last year in the Iowa Law Review, we take a pretty ambitious approach here, and you know, so much of the arguments about delegation these days are focused on a non-delegation, are focused on constitutional arguments. You know, that Congress can't delegate broad, you know, unbridled lawmaking authority to federal agencies. And in this article, we kind of take a step back and say that is a problem, sure, but another problem is the temporal aspect of delegation. In other words, a lot of the statutes that govern federal agencies haven't been revisited by Congress in decades. We might be talking about the Clean Air Act, for instance, that, you know, agencies are forced to fashion the provision of the Clean Air Act to confront completely new challenges that the enacting Congress hadn't even anticipated, in particular, global warming or greenhouse gases. Or take, for instance, the Federal Communications Act. I hear that former Chairman Pai spoke to you just a while ago. That act didn't at all envision the internet and how it should be regulated. And so in this article, we make an argument that the temporal aspects of delegation are a problem, and that one way to fix it is to encourage Congress to legislate more often, to revisit those provisions. And if I were given a different talk, I'd give you my pitch on why Congress should consider a number of different tools to require mandatory reauthorization of key statutes that govern federal agencies. So that's another tool that you have. And the last tool that could help restore Congress's role is the role of appropriations. So when you're thinking about Congress, they do two different related things when it comes to legislation. They pass legislation that substantially authorizes agencies to do something, but that doesn't actually become effective until they also appropriate funding for that. Now, your own amazing professor, Julia Metzger, has a piece coming out in your Home Institutions Law Review later this year that dives into the role of appropriations. And she argues that because legislation is so difficult, substantive legislation is so difficult to get through Congress, that we should be using appropriations more as a tool for Congress and the president to control the administrative state and to shape regulation. I think this is a tool, and if in the Q&A we can talk about this a little bit more. It's obviously a tool that can be used. It worries me that it's used this way, and I worry it gets abused. Oftentimes Congress, for instance, instead of going through oversight and substantive legislation, will add riders to change what agencies can do in appropriations legislation. And that in my mind is, it can become problematic because it bypasses the normal way that Congress functions when it's trying to change an agency's mission and organic statute. Another issue is that it tends to be more reactive and not proactive. I want a Congress that's proactively evaluating what agencies are doing and what they should be doing and providing additional instructions that way. Whole different conversation we could have if Professor Metzger were here. This would be a really fun one to have, especially she's been thinking about it so deeply over the last few years for this piece. But if you're just kind of taking a step back, you know, these are the tools. If you think that Congress not lawmaking or not being the primary lawmaker is a problem, you know, a bug and not a feature, there are a number of things Congress can do to address that. Now, I don't think any of these by itself is going to be enough. Ultimately, we as a people are going to have to value the role of Congress more in making the major values judgments in our laws and not just delegating those to federal agencies. But these are some of the means to advancing that ends if you buy into, you know, a view of our constitutional structure where legislative power is vested in Congress, and Congress is the one that's making the major decisions that affect us at a federal level every day.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I am your brother, Amir Dees Ogaya, and welcome to this Class 4 Battlefield podcast episode. In light of the train derailment, I heard a statistic that stunned me. There are over 1,000 derailments of trains in this country. That doesn't surprise me, actually. family. I mean, there's a lot that goes on that the corporate-owned media doesn't want you understanding is going on. Because corporate-owned media is more involved in the art of propaganda against criticisms of capitalism than it is dedicated towards actually informing you. Moreover, the media as it has evolved over the last 50 years is rooted less in the idea that it was an institution meant to inform you. And let me be very clear about this, ladies and gentlemen. The media, particularly the corporate media, has never really been good. Again, having read and listened to books from the 1800s, particularly the 1800s, everybody knew the media was just trash. But what was different back then was, because cost of living wasn't so bad, it didn't take much or many resources to have your own media outfit, which you could then utilize to push back against the garbage that was being projected and fomented against the public good. Moreover, and this is, you know, I'm increasingly seeing the influx of Europeans in the late 1800s as kind of this odd windfall for white people in a couple of different ways. One of those ways, obviously, is it buoyed their numbers against black, brown, and red people. But a more culturally impactive way was that a lot of these people coming over to the United States from Europe were from the old traditions. And when they came to the United States, many of them said, "Oh hell no, you ain't doing me like this, you ain't treating me like that." And so you had a contingent of European transplants, immigrants, who were very radical because they understood that the way American white people were living was just nonsense. It was absolute garbage. So they sought to change that. For this reason, there were many immigrant Europeans who turned out and turned into reporters and investigators and muckrakers, all of them dedicated to, you know, overturning the media nonsense that was becoming pervasive as the country neared the 1900s and then became all-encompassing in the early years of the 1900s. The media has always been that bad. What has changed is in the last 70 years, as technology has evolved, the media's ability to impact you at a subliminal level has increased. So much so that, you know, you can't go anywhere without being bombarded by nonsense. I mean, think about the number of public spaces you go to and you see Fox News on. Think about that. And why? Because Fox News is the fascist, corporatist, friendly channel. And so, of course, corporations are going to want a thing on that projects and promotes its sensibilities. But I didn't bring you here to talk to you about Fox News and what have you. I actually brought you here to read from you a part from this article that I stumbled upon while I was looking up libertarian principles. I came across a snippet from an essay that a man named Arnold Kling, K-L-I-N-G, NG, 68 years old, conservative libertarian, wrote for the National Affairs magazine called Designing a Better Regulatory State. The opening paragraphs of this piece that he wrote was fantastic and needed to be read aloud and commented on because it's beautiful. He should be very proud of the work that he has done here. And I'll explain why as I go through the actual substance. Beginning, this was from winter of 2022. The American ideal is sometimes described as ordered liberty. I've actually never heard that before. We want to grant people the maximum amount of freedom possible, but we also recognize that freedom should be limited by the need for order and the promotion of virtue. Now, sounds great, right? Most of you have no clue what virtue is. Virtue has to do with principles from Christianity and supposedly Christian divinity. I really, you know, it's a great piece of conservative writing that he did here. But note something, okay? One of the things that is difficult to assess when it comes to conservative writing is definitions. And so you are supposed to be in the know for all the definitions. So for instance, when he mentions the word freedom, well, freedom for a corporation is going to be different than freedom for a community which that corporation has its eyes set on to bend to its will. Freedom for a school age child is going to be different than the parents who have to work every day to put a roof, or should I say, the parents who have to be engaged in employment, because work is different than employment. You are employed against your will, against what you desire, what you aim to create. Work is something that benefits the mind, body, and soul. Most people are employed and they are not actually engaged in work. But, you know, that's my perception of it. Anyway, it'll be different than what those parents seek when it comes to freedom. And then, obviously, it would be different for those parents compared to the corporation which employs them. But that's just the first line. Let's continue. To the extent that order and liberty are in tension with each other, we seek the best resolution possible. Now, to the extent that order and liberty are in tension with each other, a premise that he hinted at in the last sentence, that order and liberty must be in tension against one another, when in fact, that's nonsense. That's nonsense. There are and have always been constructive principles within a society. I don't care if you're talking indigenous, native, or you're talking about more contemporary imperialist. There's always been principles that have been designed to maintain stability. When liberty, quote liberty, whatever that happens to mean, because that changes depending on the person who you talk to about it, when liberty becomes constrictive, at its highest form, liberty has to do with maturation, which is rooted in the natural development of the soul. When these principles become restrictive is when there is something that is present in that society that by its very nature and its activities crushes the human soul. And therefore, in order to stop the soul from rebelling, begins to put into place unnatural principles and laws that make the natural crying out, the natural rebuking, the natural fight response illegal. That must be stated here. Continuing. To the extent that order and liberty are in tension with one another, we seek the best resolution possible. The principles upon which our constitutional system was built, most notably federalism and the separations of power, are intended to allow for government to provide order while also preserving liberty. Again, it depends on who you talk to when it comes to the Constitution. Talk to Native Indigenous peoples. Talk to Africans. Talk to people who are outside of the spectrum of the Constitution. Everybody likes to talk about, let's go back to the Constitution. But when finally the Constitution sought to address the harm of slavery after the Civil War, one of the first trials that took advantage of the newly passed amendments wasn't about slavery, wasn't about the freedom of black people, but it was about the freedom of corporations. Continuing. Given the scale, and especially the complexity of modern life, the problems of advancing ordered liberty has become much more challenging in the 250 years since the American founding. The task of facilitating order in our systems of transportation, finance, and communication. Just quick note here. It's funny that he goes with transportation first and not finance, because one of them definitely poses a greater threat to social stability, health, and well-being than the other. Continuing, the task of facilitating order in our systems of transportation, finance, and communications, to name just a few, requires more than simple political negotiation. The framers of the Constitution did not anticipate political leaders having to worry about how drones might affect airline safety, how best to allocate spectrum rights, how to address the promises and perils of facial recognition technology, or how to determine whether credit default swaps or cryptocurrencies are safe financial instruments, or whether credit default swaps or cryptocurrencies are safe financial institutions. Yes, they did not predict those things, but it's important to understand that the, quote, founding fathers did not intend for the Constitution to remain static. They understood that it would have to adjust, move, and change, especially as the country grew. Continuing. Today's governance requires deep, specialized knowledge. Pause. No, let me continue, because this, it is really the next couple of paragraphs why I decided that I would read this out and make some comments. Today's governance requires deep, specialized knowledge. This makes the need for a regulatory state staffed by experts who formulate, implement, and enforce rules of conduct for many interpersonal activities inevitable. But in its current form, the federal regulatory state performs poorly. That is, it does an inadequate job of both providing order and preserving liberty. Pause. One of the reasons I brought up Mr. Klang's age, 68 years old, 40 years ago, he would have been 28. Mr. Klang does not strike me as a person who came to libertarianism in the last 10 years or 20 years or 30 years. If I was to research him, I bet I would probably find that he was libertarian conservative 40 years ago. Why is that important? Because 40 years ago would have been Reagan's time period and era. 40 years ago would have been the beginning of deregulation on steroids. 40 years ago would have been right in the middle of the first term of the government is not the answer, it is the problem. 40 years ago would have been that time period when bureaucrats became a negative term. It became a slur. You could not be a bureaucrat. Bureaucrats were terrible. They were horrible. We have to cut down the size of government, and that means getting rid of as many of these bureaucrats as possible. 40 years ago is when the dismantling of the administrative state, thank you, Steve Bannon, for giving us that phrase, because I didn't even know that that was a real phrase. Do you know there's books? And I mean books from like 50, 60 years ago, called the administrative state. Which, for those of you who do not know, the administrative state is like that portion of the brain that controls your heartbeat and your stomach and all the things that you don't have to think about within your body that keeps your body regulated and keeps your body going. But when something goes awry, that's when you start getting sick and you're like, wait, something ain't working right. That's the administrative state. But I digress. 40 years ago was when let's tear apart the regulatory state was at full throttle and going even quicker. And this guy would have been right in the middle advocating it. So when he comes out with that last paragraph where he straight up says, today's governance requires deep specialized knowledge. This makes the need for a regulatory state staffed by experts who formulate, implement, and enforce rules of conduct for many interpersonal activities inevitable. He does not say, oh yeah, by the way, and the reason why we don't have that really right now is because people like me have been advocating for the last 40 years that we tear that apart. And now look at where we're at. Can I get a redo? Continuing. At the moment, I love this part. At the moment, the debate about the regulatory state is unproductive. The right treats it as illegitimate and seeks to curtail its power. I wonder where they got that from. While the left supports the state as it currently operates and seeks to expand its responsibilities. Absolutely pause. You can't have it both ways. You cannot say that the left supports the state as it currently operates and seeks to expand its responsibilities. What kind of world have you been living in? The left seeks to expand the regulatory state responsibilities is a fact, yes. But it is because the left is so dissatisfied with the current state of the regulatory state, or the current condition, the current policies in the regulatory state, that it seeks to expand the responsibilities. Because again, over the last 40 years, people like you, Mr. Klang, have been advocating tearing apart the regulatory state. You didn't call it that all the time. You usually use buzzwords. And as for the conservatives, you might be familiar with them because you work with a bunch of them and work for a bunch of them. The Cato Institute has been crying out against bureaucrats and the regulatory state since the 70s. And the reason I bring up the Cato Institute is because the first piece that I found by him was a clip of a quote from a presentation he gave at the Cato Institution in 2013. Continuing. At the moment, the debate about the regulatory state is unproductive, you think? The right treats it as illegitimate and seeks to curtail its power, while the left supports the state as it currently operates and seeks to expand its responsibilities. This leads to naive views about government regulation in both camps. This guy. Conservatives tend to believe we could do without the regulatory state. I wonder if the Cato Institution and the Heritage Foundation and the the Economic Policy Institution and all of them had anything to do with that. Maybe even the Hoover Institution. Continuing, conservatives tend to believe we could do without the regulatory state, that we need only return to the original Constitution and its three discrete branches delineated federalist structure and explicit limits on state power to achieve better results, while progressives tend to believe independent experts know how to solve any problem and that when agencies fail to achieve their desired results, it is only because agency experts have been foiled by ignorant populists or malevolent special interests. This is a hell of a sentence. This is a hell of a sentence, and I'm going to do my damnedest not to throw this recorder against the wall while I try to break it down. Because this is why it's difficult to break down a lot of conservative writing, because the commentary is so rich, because you have to unpack the stuff they're saying. They've had 40 years to build up this vocabulary. And they've done it well. It's a hell of a web. But let me see if I can do this. Conservatives tend to believe we could do without a regulatory state. He knows everything about that. He's preached his gospel to the Cato Institution, probably spoke at the Manhattan Institution, EPI, and all the rest. He knows what he's talking about here. He also knows that this idea of returning to the Constitution has been around for quite some time, but it became in vogue again in the 1960s and 1970s. What gets me is he then comes out and says, but progressives tend to believe independent experts know how to solve any problems. Here's the thing. If we were talking about a corporation and we were not talking about the government, this man would say, leave it to the experts within the corporation. They know what they're doing. They have the experience. Shut the hell up. Leave them alone. Let them work. But because it's the government, you can't trust the experts. You can't. Now, I find that hilarious. If somebody has specialized training. I will bring it home to all of you who are listening. Let's say you have a plumbing problem. You know it's a plumbing problem. It's undeniably a plumbing problem, and you can't fix it. Are you going to call an electrician? You're going to call somebody, a mechanic for your car, to fix a plumbing problem? Now, of course, you might snicker a little bit and be like, well, I've probably called. We've all had that friend who, you know, is all purpose, you know. But if you were getting somebody with expertise at it for a plumbing problem, you'd go to a plumber. Or you'd go to somebody with that type of expertise. The government is the only entity in our society, in this society, where conservatives say the exact opposite of what they say every place else. Go to the experts, go to the experts, go to the experts. Except with government, don't go to the experts. The experts don't know nothing. Continuing. The upshot of this debate is a futile tug of war, with conservatives arguing for less regulation and less deference to agency experts, while progressives argue for more. And that's funny because it's such terrible misstatement. It's terrible misstatement. Continuing, to break free from the impetus, both sides will need to set aside, here comes the both sides, both sides will need to set aside their respective biases towards the regulatory state and consider structural reforms that would make it more effective and less prone to abuses of power. No progressive, that's the end of the first section, by the way, no progressive is asking for regulations that abuse power. Nobody's asking for that. No leftist, especially, is asking for regulations that abuse power. None. None. You could talk to the clearest Marxist, the clearest socialist, the clearest anarchist. None of them are telling you, we want regulations that abuse power. None of them will tell you that. None of them will think it. Nobody will mean it. And if you're listening to conservative media, you think that I'm kidding. But no, I'm not. These people will not go down that road. That's not who they are. As for conservatives, in the last, especially 20 years, they have proven that they will use the structures of government to abuse power. From George W. to Donald J. And then there's some other stuff in the 80s that make you kind of wonder. The whole crack thing, but that's a whole nother thing. Continuing. Why we need a regulatory state. I actually want to skip that part and go down here to the case for reform. And I thought that he had... Nope. Let's go down here. I'm actually going to go down to state capacity libertarianism. To address the regulatory state's shortcomings, progressives will have to stop pretending that the regulatory state is faultless and need only be given more authority to succeed. The view does not contribute to a constructive debate about how to manage the regulatory agencies in a way that is more likely to foster ordered liberty. Now, here's why this is important, ladies and gentlemen. I mentioned at the beginning that this was published in winter of 2022. Conservatives know something is happening in this country. Libertarians especially know something is happening in this country. You know what they know is happening? The country is moving to the left. Not just like a little bit. But this next generation, by all accounts, the one that is going to be turning 18 over the next 20 years, by all accounts, this next generation is going to be drastically left. Not only are they going to be drastically left, but their ideals, and I need to include the people who have turned 18 over the last 20 years too, their ideals are so rigidly against libertarian thinking that what these folks are trying to do is force the idea of compromise onto this generation and the forthcoming one before their minds get started growing in the way that they naturally want to. They want this generation and the forthcoming one to believe that it is their responsibility to automatically try to look for common ground with libertarians and conservatives, even though over the last 40 years, none of them have looked for common ground with even progressives. And let me remind you, progressives are essentially liberals. I know most of them don't like to think of themselves as liberals, but as I keep pointing out, if it wasn't for the housing crisis in 2008, many of the people who are running around talking about, oh, I'm part of the left, I'm a progressive, I'm part of the left, none of them people would have been. I mean, I watched Young Turks for many years, but Cenk Uygur is a conservative capitalist. He's more progressive than most conservatives because he's not dumb, but he is a conservative capitalist. Listening to him speak for years, it's pretty clear. It's pretty clear. So, that statement must be reiterated here because as I continue with this section, while I may not appreciate many things that progressives don't actually define themselves standing for, but I see that they're there, conservatives really do a disservice by misrepresenting who they are and what they stand for. So let me continue on here. Likewise, conservatives will need to abandon the fantasy of returning to a pre-regulatory state status quo. Liberty without order is not a suitable state of affairs. To bring order to contemporary American society with all its ambiguities and complexities, we will have to look to experts to promulgate, interpret, and enforce rules. Again, 40 years worth of bureaucrats are horrible. And now, oh crap, look at the mess we've created. Yo, we might need some experts. Well, wait, isn't an expert a bureaucrat? No. Two different things. Continuing. How might conservatives begin to square their aversion to administrative government with the necessities of a regulatory state? I actually have an answer for that. One, you guys can stop propagating the idea that a regulatory state is a bad idea. I know you're kind of doing it here, but your mouthpieces aren't. Two, you can actually teach people what the heck these things are and why the regulatory state came into existence. Oh, wait, you do that. But you do it from a corporate standpoint. You don't tell people that the reason the modern regulatory state came into existence was because corporations were so out of hand that they were poisoning everything and everyone that they could get their hands on. You don't tell everybody that the reason the modern regulatory state came into existence was because corporations were so out of control that they crashed the global economy. That's called the Great Depression, y'all. You don't tell everybody that the reason the modern regulatory state came into existence was because inequality was so bad that there was a legitimate, well-founded fear that there would be a revolution in this country because people were so sick of capitalism in the 1930s that they were voting for socialists and communists in record numbers. You also don't tell people, thank you to the brother who wrote the book Goliath, Matt Stoller, that, and there's a portion of that book, man, that it's just like, how is there not a book written about this? You also don't tell people the reason why the modern regulatory state came into existence was because the United States, after World War II, in trying to prevent another world war from breaking out in Europe, put a robust welfare state into Europe. That was part of the Marshall Plan. They literally took a look at the causes of the last two world wars and said, we need to have dramatic equality. That'll stop there being another major war. So we're going to put a welfare state into this continent. And we're going to take a little bit of that and sprinkle it at home at the same time. I should continue, y'all. This will be a 3-hour piece if I keep this up. How might conservatives begin to square their aversions to administrative government with the necessity of a regulatory state? As noted above, I didn't read this part, conservatives tend to believe the classical liberal notion that ordered liberty requires limiting the state's function to protecting property rights and preserving the peace. And by the way, I love how they're like, oh, this is the classical liberal notion. Son! Conservatives have been beefing about this for over 200 years. So don't be like, oh, well, this is a classical liberal. No. This also is a classical conservative notion. Continuing, this is not an illegitimate view. In practice, however, their attempts to rein in the federal government have done more to boost bureaucrats, hey, there's the word, authoritarian impulses than to weaken them. The regulatory state is the smallest, ladies and gentlemen, the regulatory, this isn't from him, this is from me, the regulatory state at this moment in time is the smallest that it's been in 60 years. Might be 70 now. A friend, who is not really a friend, And I got into an argument in 2019 about the size of the federal government. And he sent me a worksheet. And it was from the federal government where it showed that the federal government had like 29 million employees. And I was like, I know the federal government doesn't have no 29 million employees. Then I went down the list of everything that you could check. And he was counting like teachers and stuff. And as soon as I took away those, I think it was like 1.5 million, 2 million, something like that, maybe even three. Anyway, I then found a graph of the size of the federal government. And yes, I'm overstating it. It's not the smallest that it's been in 70 years. But when you don't count the Pentagon, because that's where a lot of the growth has happened, is the Pentagon and the intelligence agencies, the actual domestic functions of the federal government, the United States government is not that big compared to the size of land that it has to actually administer, especially when it comes to the services that it's administering. So there has not been any empowerment that's been happening. There has been people who have been losing consistently their capacity to do a good job. They've been saddled with more work instead of less. There were books that mentioned this back in the Bush administration. One of the things that Obama tried to do, not successfully as well as he probably wanted to, was he tried to rebuild some of these institutions. A rebuilding process that was slapped away when Trump took office. Continuing. A good example of this principle in action comes from the COVID-19 pandemic. The government's initial fumbles in the early months of 2020. Let me continue. In the early months of 2020 allowed the virus to tear through the American population, prompting widespread public outcry. In response, officials took unprecedented steps to attempt to control the spread, from shutting down businesses and closing schools to ordering the nationwide eviction moratorium. Now, may I also, ladies and gentlemen, this is why I'm telling you, this will be a 3-hour piece if I keep this up. But that emergency he's talking about is a wholly made, man-made emergency. Barack Obama, because of H1N1, and I think it was H5N1? Either way. 2009-2010, ordered the creation of all of these structures and a plan that would be put on the shelf, that could be dusted off when there was another major pandemic in the United States. Play by play, step by step. Trump comes into office, undoes all the regulatory changes he made to equip the government with the potential and resources to deal with a mass pandemic in the United States. He threw out that plan, did not back it up either, threw it out, and said it's worthless. So this example that he gives is an example of the hubris of conservative thought and libertarian thought, that the regulatory state is wasteful. Trump literally put their thinking into action and got rid of the regulation, the immediate regulation that Barack Obama put into place to handle a crisis and an emergency, which, by the way, that is part of the regulatory system in the body. That's why people get vaccines, because the body remembers the virus and then responds to attack the virus if it ever comes back. That's regulation, ladies and gentlemen. The libertarian should be proud of the mess that was created when it came to the pandemic, because that's what they built. That's what they built. And yet, this is supposed to show something else. Continuing. Another emergency that tends to prompt cause for government overreach. Oh, there's another one of those great, great, great terms that they created. Government overreach is a power outage. He's talking about Texas here, y'all. As we saw when a blizzard ravaged Texas, didn't I call it? In February of last year, a severe storm can leave tens of thousands of households and businesses without power for several days. By the way, the reason that happened in Texas was because, you may not remember this, Texas is not on the national grid. Texas has to go its own way because it thinks it's its own country or something. And, oh, by the way, until it needs federal support, then it's not its own country. And Texas does not pay more into the system than it gets from the system. Always remember that. They didn't bother keeping their grid up to national standards, and that's why they were hit the way they were hit. Continuing. Given the role that electricity plays in modern life, such outages are very costly in the terms of both money and human life. As technology continues to develop, preventing them will only become more urgent. One need only imagine what a power outage might do to communities as electric cars become predominant. A classical liberal might argue that the federal government has no authority to issue public health edicts or regulate the electricity industry. Now, again, he keeps going with this, oh, the classical liberal. It's the classical liberal. They're trying to shift blame here. They're trying to shift blame here. Yes, it's not inconceivable that the government's inability to properly respond to the next pandemic or secure the grid against inevitable storms might result in an emergency in which state officials claim, with the backing of an anxious and desperate public, new powers to ration goods and services. In this way, a government that is too weak to maintain order lends itself to authoritarian power grabs. This is an amazing statement. By the way. I talked about on this podcast, I can't remember if it was in 2013 or when, but in 2013, in my hometown, I was in a local store, Aldi's, not really local, right? And I happened to be over by, I think it was bread or flour. It was one of those. And there was this big sign that said, we reserve the right to restrict the number of items that you can take. And I was kind of, so I'm like, wait, what? Oh, I'm sorry, I said we reserve the right. We reserve the right to restrict the number of items that you can take. And I was shocked. Corporations have the right, a right that, by the way, no libertarian, no conservative, heck, no Democrat will argue against, to restrict the number of products that it produces that you can buy from it. At any time, for any reason. Just one, I feel like that's something that needs to be pointed out at this moment. Now, one of the things that does confuse me here is when I'm reading through this, he does not take into account why the government has developed an inability to properly respond to the next pandemic or secure the grid. And he doesn't do it because he knows why. The government couldn't respond to the pandemic because Donald Trump threw out the plans and fired all the people that would have done it. Just like good old libertarians and conservatives told him to. Not classical liberals, but libertarians and conservatives. The reason the United States couldn't, quote, secure the grid, which, by the way, I live in New York State, y'all. We get some snow around here. We get some ice around here. And you know something? Yes, we will have power outages periodically. But you know when it doesn't typically happen? When we have huge storms. Yes, we may have 10,000 people without power, but you know something? Usually within 48 hours, all of those people have their power back. Why? Because unlike Texas, New York State follows the national guidelines. And because we do get weather that can knock out power, there is built-in resiliency based on national guidelines to ensure if power goes out sometimes, it could be rerouted, or the teams are already on standby and they can go out and fix it within that 48-hour period that I was talking about. When he then talks about, in this way, a government that is too weak to maintain order lends itself to authoritarian power grabs, he is literally speaking about the conditions that he himself, as a libertarian conservative and other libertarian conservatives, have been literally building over the last 40 years. They wanted a weak government. They've been saying that. We want it so it gets to the size where we can drown it in the bathtub. Remember that? And now they're worried that a weak government may lend itself to authoritarian power grabs. Who do you think would be the people lending themselves to the authoritarian power grab? Oh, maybe the same people who stormed the Capitol to overturn an election because they were pissed off that their guy didn't win. Mr. Klang, the people who you are worried about lending the government towards an authoritarian power grab, look around you, my man. The call's coming from in the house. It's you and your sycophants. You would utilize the government for a power grab. And you would do it under the auspices of, we're saving capitalism and democracy. Just as Bush did. Just as Trump did. What, do you think it's going to get better? You keep saying classical liberalism as if classical liberalism is the reason that all of this is happening. It's neoliberalism and neoconservatism. And the neoliberalism isn't even about personal freedom. It's about corporate freedom. A little bit more, y'all, and then I'm done, at least for now. Recently, George Mason University professor Tyler Cohen, one of my favorite people, coined the expression state capacity libertarianism. What? To describe the view that a strong, competent government is more likely to promote ordered liberty than a weak government. Rather than start... See, again, let me just... I gotta say this again. These people are looking for an escape route now. They have created a monster. The monster is tearing apart their house and their neighborhoods, and they need a way out. This is funny to me, because none of these people were talking about this, even 2 years ago. But instead of saying, we were wrong, we need to adjust ourselves to the new reality that we were wrong, and we need to really rethink everything that we have dedicated our lives to, they make up this stuff that makes it appear like they've always been right and they've always been promoting this stuff when in fact they haven't. Remember Friedman? Milton had an almost come to Jesus moment towards the end of his life when he was watching everything that his economic philosophy had built crumble down in the housing market crash. Maybe we do need a little bit of regulation. You think? What happens when the body gets a brain injury and the regulation of the body becomes impossible because the brain is injured? You know what happens? The systems that rely on that portion of the brain to continue functioning perfectly, they stop functioning perfectly. They start breaking down. And in some instances, you take away that portion of the brain that regulates the body, you take away the brain's capacity to work. And therefore, you get somebody who's what? Brain dead. So the body may be working, but nothing's actually happening. Soon as you unplug everything, the body dies. They have been tearing apart the government, thinking it was going to have no problems. It was going to cause no problems except for this perfect world that they dreamt of. Continuing, only a little bit more, y'all, I promise. Rather than starving the government to bring it down to a size, as conservatives and libertarians alike have attempted in recent decades to do, he didn't put to do on that, by the way, a state capacity libertarian would argue that we need a government with the competence, the resources, and yes, the authority to respond to novel virus outbreaks and reduce the electricity grid's vulnerability. Why is he talking about the novel virus? Because, ladies and gentlemen, and this did not get much publicity, there was conversation back in 2021 about if humanity should expect more frequent outbreaks of very dangerous and terrible viruses. And you know what most people said? I'm sorry, most expert people, most people who have been studying this stuff for the last 25, 30 years said, yes, 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 yes. You know why? Because humanity, based on the philosophies that this guy has been pushing for 40 years and other people like him, have crushed and crashed up against a natural barrier. And you know what's happening with that natural barrier? That natural barrier is revealing some horrible things that Mother Nature had kept locked away because, you know, death and destruction would ensue. There is fear that the next major virus won't just be as contagious as some of these other variants, but be significantly more deadly. And they have a right to fear. Continuing. Competent governance during pandemics, power outages, and other emergencies would diminish calls for greater government intervention during times of crisis. No way! It's called institutional memory, you dumb. I bet you, see now, again, if we were talking corporations, all of this stuff he would know. But because it's government, they think it doesn't, their brains do not seem to understand the reason government was created. It was created to take the functions that people needed to rely on each day for life and to systematize them so it just was automatic. That was the reason government existed. The last part, y'all. In keeping with this philosophy, conservatives would do well to think less about abolishing the regulatory state and more about how to reform it in ways that enable it to govern effectively while guarding against abuse. Now look, I'll be fair. I don't know Mr. Kling's work significantly well, so he could have been promoting this stuff for 40 years. But the reason I am using this is because, seriously, this... he had so many catchphrases in there, so many dog whistle phrases, and he put forward such an interesting argument while utilizing the arguments and talking points that have been popularized over the last 40 years that if I didn't use this, I would have been derelict of duty, you know, or it would have been a dereliction of duty. Sorry about that. Anyway, that's all I'm going to read from it. There's significantly more that I didn't touch on, and maybe I will, actually, and, like, do a second part of this. Again, National Affairs, Designing a Better Regulatory State by Arnold Kling, K-L-I-N-G, from winter of 2020. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, and by the way, I haven't done this in a long time where I take an article, read it through, and comment, but I love doing it. So don't be surprised if you see many more of these, because I really do love doing it. It's quite fun. Questions, comments, concerns, you can always reach out to me. I am your brother, Vimeri D. So, got ya. Don't forget, support me, CWB Podcast, Cash App it, PayPal it. I am your brother, Vimeri D. So, got ya. Until the next one, y'all. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and they're